Hello and welcome to the Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. I'm your host, Nick Agar Johnson, and I'm back once again with Ignacio Rizzotto to talk about one of our shared favorite players in this international class, in this draft class period. Ignacio, how are you doing this fine evening?
I'm so excited that we finally have the chance to, you know, rant and go on tangents about this player that every time we do one of our mock drafts, which are like open court, open mic style, when everybody can throw a player and discuss a player in the No Ceilings mock drafts that we do in the calls. We tend to say Juan Nunez about what I would say we share about 10 times per mock draft that we throw Juan Nunez out there to be considered to be selected. And we get rejected. Once
about
and
10 to 15
again.
Times a mock draft and about 10 to 15 spots ahead of where anybody else mentions him.
Yeah, definitely. So for me, and also for me, it's a player that I've been watching since he was, I want to say 15 years old, because he came out, he was a pretty early standout in this, in his international generation, which is the 2004 generation. He was always playing up in age. In fact, funny like trivia piece, he was teammates with Isan Almanza, with both Isan Almanza and Alex Sarr. They were all in Real Madrid at the same time. But even though Juan is 1 year older, he never played in the same teams or divisions as them, because he was just so advanced for his age that he was playing with the guys who were 1 or 2 years older. So yeah, a player that I've been following for a while, and him being like near close to getting drafted is a really cool moment.
Yeah, it's Real Madrid, so it's not that surprising, but it is still insane when you look at the list of players that have gone through that system in the past, you know, 10, 20 years.
Yeah, I think I want to say that they got a player. So 99 is the generation of Luka Doncic. I think they got a player either drafted or in the NBA in at least getting a summer league contract or getting like a training camp contract. I think they got one player in each generation, because 2002 is the Garuba generation. 2003, they have Tristan Vukcevic, and Mateo Spagnolo got drafted. He's stashed by the Timberwolves. And in 2004, they might get Juan Nunez. 2005 is Alex Sarr, Isan Almanza. And 2006, next year, they will have Hugo Gonzalez. Egor Demin is probably going to high major college, and you know, it's probably going to be like that. One, at least one player every year is going to at least has passed through that system at some point in their careers.
The train just keeps on chugging for them. But we're here to talk about your recent article on Juan Nunez, and just talk about Juan overall, because he's fun to talk about. But you recently wrote for No Ceilings on the four paths for Juan Nunez. And so before we get into detail on those four paths, let's just sort of start with what allows him to have those multiple paths to the NBA in the first place, which is that he is an exemplary passer. He's clearly, in my mind, the best passer in this class. You mentioned him right at the top of the article as one of the best passers you've ever seen. And I'm not going to dispute that by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, I also wrote about him relatively recently for editor's notes. And the thing that, you know, stood out to me was just the level of control over a game that he has as a teenager playing in a high quality professional league. It's not something that comes around very often. And, you know, it's something that, again, you know, the four paths that we'll get into don't entirely focus on the passing, but I think they're only possible because he is such an elite passing talent.
Yeah, and I think for me is that his floor is being an exceptional passer. He has been, like, you mentioned how kind of insane it is for a teenager to be able to see the floor and make the reads and the deliveries and the way that he does. But the truth is that he's been doing this since he was 15, 16 years old. And he has just, I wouldn't say he has improved a ton as a passer. I just think the vision and the creativity was always there. I think he maybe added one or two like passing techniques, and he has gotten a second, like a split second quicker, but he was always like this. And it's, I think that no matter the level of competition that he goes to, he's always going to be an exceptionally creative and accurate and reactive passer. It's the other things in his profile, like, okay, beyond the passing, like in this day and age in the NBA, you can't just do just one thing and end up in the NBA. Yeah. So what else does he need to add to his profile? And, you know, we can talk about, we can see other like quote unquote pass first point guards in the last 5 to 10 years. Okay, what did they do? What did they add to their game? What they contributed to their teams to be valuable players while not being, you know, primary scorers or like all defensive team type of defenders? That's the big question with Juan. That has to do more with, you know, the archetype and the value of the pass first archetype than it has to do with his exceptional skill set as a passer.
So I do want to get into the pass first query that you put in the piece in a moment and then move from there into the four paths. But I do want to pick your brain about something specific first, which is, I've watched quite a lot of Juan Nunez film, but I am not going to pretend that I've watched anywhere near as much as you have. And more to the point, I'm not going to pretend that I've watched anywhere near as much of his, you know, 14, 15, 16 film as you have. How much do you think his sort of, you know, passing growth, minimal as it might be, how much do you think it's just is just confidence? Because for me, there are a lot of players who are in the sort of caretaker point guard mold, which, you know, you reference a number of them in the pass first query that we'll get into in a moment, you know, but the typical sort of example is the Jones brothers, right? Of caretaker point guards who never make a mistake. And I think that's almost limiting a bit as a passer, because there are some windows that Juan Nunez hits that you can't, like, certainly you're not going to make those passes if you don't have some sort of audacity that I don't necessarily associate with those sort of caretaker point guards. So how do you think that has evolved over the past few years? Because certainly, you know, watching him at Ulm this past year, his confidence as a passer was absolutely off the charts.
That's something that I will be honest, didn't cross my mind. And I think it's a really good point. If I had to compare him to an NBA player just as a passer, considering the skills necessary to be a passer, but also like the confidence to make those reads and attempt those and just the sheer guts to attempt some of the passes he does, I think the only player that comes to mind is Luka Doncic. And it's interesting because for me, he's the best passer in the international game since Luka. Josh Giddey might have come close at some points, but I would definitely take Juan over Josh Giddey purely as a passer. I think Luka, what Luka had was the scoring ability to open up more passing lanes that Juan just because of the size and some other limitations that, you know, we'll get into, he doesn't have the ability to open those passing lanes that Luka did. But he's in terms of sheer confidence, I think he's just right there with Luka. And I think you might be able to draw a line from his confidence to his ability to become a better scorer than, you know, what everyone and what, especially what I project him to be. I'm not especially down on him. Like, I'm not the lowest guy on him as a scorer. I just think that the floor, which is what I wanted to see at the beginning of the piece, I think if the floor is him not just being a pure passer, okay, what's the minimum level of scoring that he has to do to be a valuable NBA player? But definitely he doesn't lack, at least as a passer, he does not lack confidence.
So let's run through that pass-first query that you have at the top of the piece first before we get into the first of the four paths that you mentioned. So there are six players in this query that you ran. So in order that you, the order that you have them, which is assist to turnover ratio, lowest to highest, we have Elfrid Payton, Cameron Payne, DeLon Wright, Trey Jones, Monty Morris, and Tyus Jones. And the last three are really the first sort of guys that come to mind for me of, you want a point guard who is never going to make a mistake. Those are your three guys. And so I think they're a very telling group to sort of go through the comparisons for Juan Nunez. But let's start with that first path now. And the first path is excelling around the basket. So, you know, you have numbers from campaigns 2020-21 season, DeLon Wright's 2022-23, Trey Jones, same season, Monty Morris, same season, and Tyus Jones, 2017-18 season, where they were all at or above 66.6% from the rim. So basically making two-thirds of their shots around the basket. And with Juan Nunez, I think, you know, obviously the passing is his greatest offensive skill, but in terms of his scoring game, I think that this is the easiest path for me to imagine because he is very good at getting to the rim and finishing once he gets there. And, you know, you mentioned Luka's scoring game opening up passing angles for him, and Juan Nunez is not the same level as a scorer. I think if he was, he would be the clear number one pick in his class, but I think Luka was the clear number one pick in his class, and look how that turned out.
Yeah.
But for Juan, you know, his ability to get to the rim and score at the rim is, I think, going to be, for me, the easiest of the four paths that you lay. Well, we'll get there, but certainly very easy for me to see him being someone who is exceptional at the basket. Even if he's not, you know, a Ja Morant level leaper at the point guard spot, I think his craft around the rim, his ability to get there, and of course with Juan, the threat of collapsing on him when he's driving to the basket is he's going to hit a laser that's going to make you regret ever coming close to him. So I don't know. What are your sort of thoughts on that potential for him at the basket? Because I think that's pretty easy for me to see working out.
I think you nailed it when you mentioned the word craft. I think that's how you would define Nunez's game as a driver, as a slasher, and as someone who is able to create his own drives and is able to find his way to the rim with the ball in his hands. Really fluid, a guy who can get defenders off balance and off positions with crossovers and hand dribbles and changes of directions. Really somebody who's going to be able to exploit mismatches and also utilize screens to get downhill. But I don't think he's one of those guys, and that's, I think, the limitation. He doesn't have the size, going back to the Luka comparison, he doesn't have the size to just back down opponents. And so he can get through them. He can get through, like, point guard or on-ball perimeter defenders out of sheer physicality, and he just doesn't have the explosive ball handling or the first step to get by his primary defender one-on-one. He has to utilize those dribble moves and just try to exploit mismatches. The good news is that when he does get to the rim, he's a really great finisher. He is at 63.4% in the restricted area during this season. He attempts 4 shots per game in the restricted area, and that percentage would rank him right around, like, right above average in terms of NBA guards. For somebody who's, yes, he's on a lower level of competition, but it is a physical league, and also he's just, 19 years old, I think? Yeah, he's 19. He will turn 20 in early June. So there's definitely a place for improvement, especially for somebody who's not really super developed in terms of strength, but does have a frame that could really fill out in time.
Sorry, I just want to stick with that for a moment. That's interesting you say that, because I think his strength is maybe his most underrated physical trait. Like, we'll get into it with the defense stuff, which will be an interesting discussion, certainly. But, like, I felt like he was much more stout than I expected for a 19-year-old. And, you know, at 6'3", he's not ever going to be towering over anybody. But, you know, if there's any lesson that anybody learned from Jalen Brunson in these playoffs, you don't have to be more than 6'2" if you're... And I don't expect anyone to get to Jalen Brunson's level of being able to push people around, because his strength is, you know, next level for a guard of his size. But I think that's a really underrated part of Nunez's physical profile, is he's a lot more stout than most 19-year-olds. I mean, you know, I had Metcalf on a few months ago to talk about AJ Johnson, and, you know, the difference in just heft between the two of them is staggering. And I think for Juan, that's an area where, you know, I don't think he's ever... I brought up John Morant as just sort of a, you know, throwaway comparison of, you know, the most elite, you know, athlete at 6'2", 6'3" range, right? But if Juan can get to the point where, you know, he's strong enough to muscle guys out of the way, I think that's a potential area for him that could be, you know, really helpful, in the sense of, you know, maybe the vertical athleticism won't be there, but I don't know. I buy into the strength as a part of his physical profile anyway.
I think he has another step to take. Sure. And I in the sense that I don't think he's the finished product, just because of how he's a guy that has, for his size, I wouldn't say he has like a narrow frame. I would also wouldn't characterize him as having like broad shoulders. I think he's just well proportioned, if that's even a term. But he's somebody that, like, he doesn't shy away from physicality, but he tends to get thrown off balance too often for my taste, especially around the rim. And what's interesting is that those off balance shots, that he can make them, like that 63.4% around the basket, is including a ton of shots that are super difficult off balance shots where he just bounces off opponents. I would say that there's also a level of him being somebody that exploits mismatches more than somebody that goes at perimeter, like at opposing point guards or opposing one defenders. And so that means that he attacks bigger players generally, and that might get him thrown off balance. But I definitely think he's, I would say, above average for somebody his size and his age in terms of strength. But I think he has definitely another step or two to take in terms of his sheer strength. And I think that will help him become a better, even better finisher at the NBA level, or at least mitigate some of the concerns with the leap in level of competition when it comes to finishing around the basket.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, 63.4% is slightly below the thresholds of the examples that you gave, but, like, if the improvements that he can make mesh with the, you know, jump in difficulty to going up to the NBA level, like, if he's at 63% around the basket, you know, especially if he's at 63% around the basket early on, I think that's, you know, more than good enough to sort of meet the qualification for that path. But I do want to move on to path two, which is find a way to thrive as a jump shooter. And this is a conversation that's fascinating to me because this is a lot of what I wrote about when I wrote about Juan for my editor's notes piece a while ago, which is, yeah, the 3-point shooting number on the surface looks a lot uglier than you would hope for, but so much of his jumper numbers are skewed by the fact that he's taking 80% of them off the dribble, which is a massive number and one that, you know, even the best players in the league are less efficient at shooting off the dribble than, well, the average off the dribble shooter is much less efficient than the average, you know, catch and shoot, stand still, open 3-pointer. And so for Nunez, it's like, yeah, okay, you know, the raw 3-point percentage number looks a bit ugly, but when you dig into it even a little bit, it's like, oh, the volume that he's taking is ridiculously difficult. And 32% is not great, but it's far from, I think, the really problematic level that some people might think it is if they just look at 31.7% and say, oh, that's ugly. There's a lot behind that number.
Yeah, and I'm always on team shooting versatility matters when it comes to projecting a shooter to the NBA level. You know, there's a lot of things to take into account when projecting a shooter, whether that is just numbers in terms of like both percentages and volume and free throw percentages. And then you have the guys who are shot mechanic truthers out there who, like, if you need to have perfect mechanics, and then you have people who are more into, okay, what's the shot versatility, what is the difficulty of shots he's taken? And then you have the, okay, what's the general level of touch, which is one of the most subjective things that you can evaluate. So there's a lot. There's a lot of ways to evaluate how a player is going to be as a jump shooter once they make the leap to the NBA. I try to take a bit of everything into account. And when I look at Nunez, he definitely checks some of the boxes. The shooting versatility is the first one, that the one that he mentioned, and he's definitely checking that. He's at 0.82 points per shot in dribble jumpers, which is not ideal, but right around the average of this class. Just to go through some of the other guards, Tyler Kolick is at 0.81 with less than half the attempts. Nikola Topic is at 0.89 with less than half the attempts. Isaiah Collier is right around the same mark in points per shot with around half the attempts. So, you know, that's in terms of shooting off the dribble, that's kind of, he should be in the same discourse as them, at least in terms of numbers. And he takes, like you mentioned, about 80% of his jumpers off the dribble. And that just comes from him playing in such a, in a role where he has the ball in his hands most of the time. As a pass for first point guard in a league and in a system that really values your point guard having the ball in his hands most of the time. So that leaves him like very little space to be off the ball and get open jumper opportunities off the ball.
Yeah. So in addition to the editor's notes piece that I wrote a bit ago, I also did a collaborative piece with Nick Thomas over on Nick Thomas's Substack about Juan Nunez. And Nick wrote about his shooting. The other Nick wrote about his shooting. And I think it's the kind of thing where there's reason to buy in if you're willing to, you know, sort of dig deeper into the numbers. And, you know, Nick wrote about his shooting for the piece. And that's, you know, I think with Nunez, a lot of it is that there's sort of this, what's the best way to put this? There's sort of a combination here, I think, of like the shooting is, you know, there's positive indicators in there. There are also, as we'll get into in just a minute, some negative indicators in there. But, you know, when you sort of combine that with his ability to get to the rim and convert around the basket, it's the kind of thing where when you have a point guard who has the ball in his hands all the time, a lot of the issue that they have to solve is, you know, okay, what do I do when X, right? And usually when you're talking about a guard, it's like, what do I do when I'm forced off the three-point line, right? And, you know, what do I do if I'm sort of forced into the mid-range area and there isn't, you know, an easily available passing window and I have to figure out something to do? You know, I think the player I talked about this the most with was Jaden Ivey in preparation for his draft year, because he had a very bereft mid-range game, which sort of made it something where it's like, okay, if he gets all the way to the rim, he's ridiculous. If he's shooting from three-point range, mileage may vary on his shot. I bought in quite a bit before the draft, and this year certainly vindicated me more than last year on that front. But with Nunez, I think it's very interesting in the sense of, again, sort of what you mentioned is when he's got the ball in his hands, he can figure out a lot of stuff to do, but he'll need to be more valuable when he doesn't have the ball in his hands to make a lot of that work, because, you know, I don't think he's ever going to get the same kind of Rajon Rondo level of defensive indifference when he's beyond the three-point line. But if he can't be at least a little bit better as a standstill shooter, then that will make it easier for defenses to cramp his space. But that being said, I think because he's a ball-dominant point guard type, the most important aspect of his shooting profile for me is his shooting off the dribble. And I wrote about Daron Holmes earlier this season because I love writing about Daron Holmes and I write about as much as I can get away with. But, you know, with him, it was he essentially added a 3-point shot this year and it was entirely standstill. He wasn't doing anything off the dribble. He wasn't doing anything other than like he'll get a kick out beyond the arc and he'll shoot. And for him as a 6'10 combo big man, that's the most important part of his shooting profile. For Juan Nunez, it's the off the dribble stuff. And so, you know, if they were flipped, then yeah, maybe I'd be more confident about the instances when Juan doesn't have the ball in his hands, but he's going to provide his most value when he's dissecting defenses. And for him to be able to dissect defenses effectively, I think the off the dribble stuff is a more important part of the shooting profile. And so the fact that that I'm more comfortable with than some of the other stuff is a positive sign, even if it still means there's a lot of room for improvement.
Yeah, the off the ball on ball shooting is an interesting conversation. And the fact that we're even having this conversation about Nunez is because and the whole conversation about if what's the value of pass first point guards at the NBA level. The entire reason why we're having this conversation is because in recent years, instead of every time you grab a defensive rebound, instead of passing to your point guard, you pass to generally the guy who scores the most. And that's why even if Boston has Derek White and Jrue Holiday and Peyton Pritchard, that's why Jason Tatum brings the ball up most of the time. And that's why in the Clippers previous to Harden and Westbrook, it was either Kawhi Leonard or Paul George. Because the NBA and Giannis and Milwaukee and a bunch of other examples, the leading scorer is now the guy who sets up the offense. Because even if they don't have like the elite vision of guys like Nunez or guys that appeared in the query, they can just generate for teammates out of sheer scoring gravity. That's why Anthony Edwards brings the ball up for Minnesota more than Mike Conley. So the entire reason why we're having this conversation is because point guards, if they can score, they don't have the ball in their hands as much as they used to. So that's why being valuable off the ball, like you mentioned, is so important. Because if they don't score, if they're not able to score, I don't know, 20 a game, 15 a game, which was the 15 a game was the maximum points per game that I had in the squarey. If they don't score, if they're not able to score 15 a game on decent efficiency, they're not going to have the ball in their hands as much. The leading scorer of the team is going to have the ball in their hands. So that's why it's important for Nunez or for any pass first point guard to be a viable option off the ball. And most of the players that I mentioned in the query had most of, like had great seasons from 3-point range, but most of the other shots they took were assisted, were not self-created. And so that's, I think, the path for Nunez. Will he become a competent shooter off the catch? I don't know, because he's never been in that situation. So it's really hard to, you know, put my foot down and say, yes, he will become a great shooter. I will say that the shot versatility and the touch, both in shots off the dribble and the touch around the basket, and just the shooting form and the footwork, I think it should indicate that he could become at least a passable shooter at the NBA level. The free throw percentages being always below 70% in every season, that kind of scares me. But yeah, that there's a reason why I don't, you know, just call my shot and say he will become a great shooter. It's because he was just never put in that situation. And I don't know, when he gets the ball taken out of his hands, I don't know how it looks.
Yeah, you brought up the free throw percentage, so I didn't have to. That's a concern that I always am worried about for players, especially given that the combination of variance and volume on free throws usually, I mean, almost always when you're talking about college players, but you know, even in international sample sizes, like the normalization of free throw shooting is a lot, happens a lot faster and is a lot less volatile than 3-point shooting, which often means that free throw shooting numbers translate better to 3-point shooting numbers at the NBA than certainly, you know, college 3-point shooting numbers on a very low volume of attempts. But that's the other part of the problem with Juan, is exactly as you mentioned, we don't know what he's going to look like when he doesn't have the ball in his hands all the time, because we've never seen it before. Like he's been so good as a passer and creator and on-ball guy for the entirety of his basketball playing career that he's never had the ball taken out of his hands in any context. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, normally you see with, you know, American prospects when it's like, okay, transitioning from high school to college, right? Of like, by far the best player anywhere near them in high school going to, now I have to compete at a high major college level. That's often a very big, you know, sort of transition for, okay, can I figure out what to do as a role player when I'm not the guy, you know, point blank period. It's like, unless you played at Montverde or something, like you're going to have been the guy on your high school team. For Nunez, he's basically been, you know, I mean, he's been playing in, you know, professional leagues internationally. So, you know, he's had to deal with locker room dynamics and veterans who are decades older than him, but he's never had the ball taken out of his hands. And so it's very hard to parse, you know, the very limited volume of times that he's not been the guy who's been asked to create everything.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. And it's going to be, and that's why I think, going back to the purpose of the piece, I think that not a lot of guys can really make that transition. So if it's an interesting dilemma with Juan, because taking the ball out of his hands, just you would neutralize his biggest impact, which is as a passer. So that's why I think the floor for me, that's why I compared him with other guys who ended up being either like starting point guards, but you know, the fifth best starter in the case of maybe Cameron Payne. I think he had a season as a as a full-time starter. Or you have guys who are like really great backup point guards. And I think that's where if Juan's strength is as a guy who can run the offense but doesn't have the scoring ability to get the like get most of the on-ball reps with when all the starters are there, I think the strength will be to give him the on-ball reps when there's the starters and the guys who can, you know, self-create and score 20 plus a game on good efficiency are not on the floor.
So let's breeze through path three quickly because A, it's not as fun, and B, because path four, I think is a lot more fun to talk about. Path three, can he make an impact defensively? You answer this as doubt it. And yeah, that's basically where I'm at. I mentioned, you know, sort of feeling like his strength was a pretty solid physical tool earlier. And I think for me, a lot of that was he did a much better job in the post when guys that were, you know, much older than him and much bigger than him in many cases tried to back him down. I was pleasantly surprised by the few instances when he was sort of asked to defend in the post, box guys out, do any of those sorts of things. The rest of the defense, and you know, that's not a defensive assignment that he's going to get very often at the NBA level, by the way. And the defensive assignments that he will get at the NBA level most of the time, I'm concerned. I'll say that much. I am very much in the same boat as you, as I would be stunned if Juan Nunez becomes a defense first, second, third, or even like 15th kind of player.
Yeah, I think he's one of those guys that you have to think, instead of thinking how can he help us defensively, it's more like how can we mitigate the negative impact that we'll get by having him on the floor on defense. I don't think I don't think it's even a matter of either effort or defensive IQ. I just don't think he has the tools to be a positive on-ball defender. It's difficult for him to navigate screens, to stay in front of drivers. Doesn't really have the technique. He's too upright. I just don't see it. I have rarely seen, especially in the later, in his latest steps of his career, like the past two seasons at Ulm, I haven't seen him like just get in front of a driver and, you know, stay in front of him and contest a shot at the rim. Not somebody that like gets blown by out of quickness. He's just, yeah, he's just too slow to stay in front, not strong enough to like really make his physicality felt on the defensive end, and doesn't have either the technique or the size to compensate. I know that sounds harsh, but I just don't see anything else on tape. I do think that he can contribute with like the best moments are when you see him like anticipate passes, and it's like, it's kind of, you can almost see his thought process of like, oh, this guy has the ball in his hands. If I had the ball in his hands, in my hands, I would make this pass. And so he gets in front of the guy who's about to receive the pass, and he can take off for layups on the opposite end of the floor when he steals the ball. So that's an aspect where he really contributes, playing off the ball. But otherwise, the lateral movement. Even in like a lot of times he was defending in the corner and he was asked to like stunt and recover or like take digs at the ball if he was the strong side corner defender. And even returning to his man in the corner, if his opponent like kicked out the ball to the open guy in the corner, even returning to the corner and contesting in time was a struggle for him. If there's a path for him to, like, if the path to becoming a valuable player on the NBA relies on his defense, I just don't think there's a path for him considering the production and the physical tools and just the lack of defensive technique on the ball.
I want to push back on one element of that and before we move on to the next section. And unfortunately for Juan Nunez defenders, it's to push it in an even more negative direction. I think that even with the, you know, athletic limitations, as it were, I still think he's way worse at navigating screens than he should be. Like he's strong enough and he is, you know, again, the basketball IQ is more than high enough for him to know when he should be fighting over versus going under screens. And he just shows absolutely no fight in that area at all. And that's the kind of thing that is really concerning for me, because it's like, that's one of the things, you know, and I, you know, don't, I can't speak to the defensive scheme, certainly not as much as you did in the piece, but just generally, that's the kind of thing that I think it's honestly something that has come up for me with this class more than previous classes, where there are quite a few top tier guys in this draft who are just awful at screen navigation. And so maybe it stands out to me more than it should, because I sort of have that bias in the back of my head of this class in particular being really bad at that. But Juan has the tools to be better than he has been at screen navigation. And that's the kind of effort related thing where, you know, again, some of it is scheme, of course. Sometimes, you know, the idea of the scheme is to go under the screen, sure, but he just does not show anywhere near enough fight over screens. And it's the kind of thing where maybe I would feel more positive about his ability to figure out more on the defensive end if he was better at that. But because he isn't, it's almost like I'm more pessimistic on his ability to figure things out, because he stands out so starkly in that area as not having done what he needs to do.
I'll be honest, I didn't get into Olm's defensive scheme as much as I did for my previous piece on Alex Saar, just because I thought defense was, you know, a more integral part of Saar's profile as an NBA prospect than defense is for Nunez. Ratio form, by all means, kind of a middle of the road team defensively when it comes to 3-point percentages and rim protection and just opponent points per game. Really good at forcing turnovers, but otherwise just a middle of the pack team. So maybe there's some type of scheme where they ask Juan to die on ball screens, but that would be strange. That would be definitely strange. Maybe they got the same defensive scheme that the Perth Wildcats have, which was, if you didn't listen to our previous podcast on Alex Saar, but that's one of the worst perimeter defensive teams in the entire history of my entire basketball watching history. Being serious, yeah, I think screen navigation was particularly bad this year. I wouldn't say it was like Josh Giddey levels of bad back when he was in Australia, but yeah, I would say it's pretty close. The only reason why it's not to Josh Giddey's level, it's because Juan, by virtue of being smaller, just quicker than Giddey was.
So let's now move on to path four, which is one of my favorite subheads that anyone has ever put in a No Ceilings article that I've edited. Path four, be the one guy who knows what the fuck you're doing.
Thank you. So, glad you like it.
Oh, it was beautiful. But so this is where, and so for those of you who have been reading along with the piece while you're listening, or read the piece and then listen to the podcast, Alfred Payton doesn't show up in the first three paths. And the reason for that is because he is the definitional figure for path four. So I'm just going to let you run wild here because this was a ton of fun and I want to get your opinion out there before I riff off it.
So basically, like, there's a backstory for that, and that's that year, that particular year, 2019-2020, Alfred Payton saved my fantasy season. So I remember.
Why am I not surprised that this is the real reason behind Alfred Payton?
I remembered him being having one season of decent production, at least decent statistical production. And so when I went and did the query, that 2019-20 season for him showed up. And it was basically, for those not really into the New York Knicks lore of the last decade and a half, that season, basically, they fired Fizdale, their coach, after 18 games, after 22 games. And after he gets fired, Alfred Payton comes back into the lineup, first coming off the bench, then ends up being a starter. And they go 4-17 without him, and they go 17-28 with him. Not exactly a winning team, but definitely way better than they were without him. And the reason why is that the Knicks didn't, like, the leader in assist for that team was Julius Randle. And yes, they had another quote-unquote point guards like Dennis Smith Jr. or Frank Ntilikina, but they didn't know how to run an offense. In fact, their lack of, I don't want to say lack of ability, but them not being able to run an offense on a primary level is probably the reason why they have been on the way out of the NBA for a while, and why Alfred Payton, despite not being a great shooter, or despite not being like an all-defensive type of defender, or not someone who can really attack the rim and be efficient as a rim finisher. That's why Alfred Payton played I think about 500 games in the NBA and started about 400 of them. And that's what brings me to, there's always value and there's always a market for guys who know what the fuck they are doing. And Juan has been that guy ever since I watched him for the first time when he was 14 years old, has been that through Real Madrid to the Spanish national team, through Ratio Farm. And he's going to be that guy at the NBA. He's going to be a guy that, whenever he has the ball in his hands, he's going to make the right decision. He's going to make the right pass. And he's going to exploit every defensive mistake. He's going to find the open man, wherever he is on the floor. Because one of the biggest points with Juan is that every player on the floor is one pass away when Juan has the ball in his hands.
Yeah.
And that's extremely helpful and extremely useful, because whenever he makes the skip pass, whenever he makes the pass to the weak side corner, he can make the entire defense shift and create two-on-one opportunities or create hard closeouts. And that's what he's been doing his entire career. And I think there's value in that. And even, like, I think the Alfred Payton example shows that even if you're not the best shooter, even if you're not the greatest scorer at the rim or the greatest defender, I think there's value for some teams on having a guy who knows what he's doing. And, like, I think one of the last, you know, sentences of the article is, when you're in the thick of the season and your team, like your leader in assist is Julius Randle, no offense to Julius, but he's not a primary playmaker. When you're in that spot, you'll be happy to have a guy like an Elfrid Payton, like a Monte Morris, like a Tyus or Trey Jones, like Cameron Payne, or like a Juan Nunez on your team. Believe me that you'll be happy to get a guy like that. That's why San Antonio was better with Trey Jones on the floor this year. That's why Washington was better with Tyus Jones on the floor, or that's why Washington was awful when they didn't have somebody to run the offense. And I think Juan Nunez can fix those sort of situations.
You beat me to the punch. I was going to bring up Trey Jones in particular because that I understand the theory, and I'm not going to pretend to. Greg Popovich has forgotten more about basketball in the last 3 days than I've ever known in my life. But the Jeremy Sochan point guard experience in San Antonio was confounding to me because they had someone on the team who was, on this list of the Elfrid Payton archetype of, hey, just someone who you bring into the game and they lower everybody's blood pressure by a little bit and they make the right plays. And, I think with Trey and Tyus, there's a bit more of a caretaker element, whereas Juan, I think, is, significantly above either of them as a passing talent. But the concept there is, I think, exactly the same of like when Trey Jones was in with Victor Wembanyama, the Spurs were a positive team. And when, especially earlier in the season, when Trey was on the bench and Victor was out there with Sochan as the point guard, they were like a negative net 20 net rating team or something ridiculous like that. It's like, okay, so a lot of everything on the offensive end works better with Trey Jones in the lineup than not. And it's like, it's not, there are multiple reasons why this is the case, but it's certainly not surprising to me at all that the end of the season when Trey Jones was the starting point guard, like the last half of the season, the Spurs offense was orders of magnitude better than their offense the first half of the season, which is, part of why their record was better down the stretch. Part of that was Wembanyama figuring out even more than he already had, which is an insane sentence to say out loud. But like post All-Star break, the Spurs offense just made a lot more sense. And it was because they had someone running the offense who made a lot more sense than Sochan. And I think there are, the Spurs could bring Trey Jones back. The Wizards could bring Tyus Jones back. But if they don't, those are very easy landing spots for me to see for Juan Nunez, another team that, I think it's more just dependent on how much Keyonte George is going to be the on-ball point guard. But like having a Juan Nunez off the bench might be really helpful for a Jazz team that, is going to want to have the ball in Lauri Markkanen's hands when the starting lineup is out there, and have the ball in Keyonte's hands when the starting lineup is out there. There are, it's not all 30 teams where there's a clear and obvious, like, okay, Juan Nunez makes a lot of sense for this team, but like the Kings, right? Like the team that I spend the most time following, even with Malik Monk, they desperately needed more players who could reasonably attack the basket. And, that's not the strongest skill for Nunez, but it's up there among his better skills. And man, just the rim pressure that he would create and the openings that he would create for the shooters on the team. Like, he's not going to start over De'Aaron Fox, but there's definitely 15 minutes a game the Kings could use from Juan Nunez, even if Malik Monk does come back. And if Malik doesn't come back, then the Kings are in even more trouble on that sort of attacking the basket front. It's like, there are teams where he makes sense as a potential starter. There are teams where he makes sense as a potential guy off the bench. And just like with basically every draft prospect, there's going to be a degree to which fit sort of determines what happens. But ultimately, there are a lot of teams mired near the bottom of the NBA that can use a point guard who just knows what the fuck he's doing. And Juan Nunez is that guy.
I do understand why the reasoning behind giving the ball to Sochan in the season. And I can already feel the Spurs fans listening to this hating us more than they already do.
What did I do to the Spurs fans?
When I mean we, is like no ceilings as a collective. And if you don't think they hate us, just go look at the quotes on every mock draft that we do. But I do understand that there might be some pushback on this, like, oh, why do we want to like get a point guard to get better when we are just in the first season after a colossal tank job, and we want to like not be so good that we miss out on top picks. And I'm going to get close to the microphone for a second. I swear, I don't want to go on a tangent here, but I absolutely need to. You don't want to be the worst team in the NBA. Go look at the past 25 to 30 years of the worst team in the NBA and look at how many of those players in the worst team were there for the next iteration of a somewhat successful franchise. You won't find many. You won't find many.
You can just say the Sacramento Kings out loud.
No, there's a lot of examples. Even if being the worst team in the NBA gets you the number one pick, which these days it doesn't. It's not the case anymore. Ask Detroit. You don't want to be the worst team in the NBA. You want to do those marginal improvements that allow you to be, yes, not a playoff team, but a better bad team, because it helps your players learn how to win in the NBA. And that when you're 2 years, 3 years into their careers, that matters. I assure you that the sooner they learn how to win in the at the NBA level, you know, I assure you that you're helping their development. So, I mean,
just looking at any interview that Cade Cunningham did with his 1,000-yard stare of like looking like he'd just been shelled in a trench, like after Detroit lost their 72nd consecutive game. It weighs on people. And, you know, that's just the obvious humanity of it, right? It's like, if you just think on the most basic level, yeah, it would suck to go out there and know that you're going to lose pretty much every night.
I guess what I'm trying to say is, RC, Buford, Pop, you have the 48th pick. Just think about it. That's all.
All right. So before we wrap up, I just do want to circle back to the last line of the piece, because I can't think of a better way to close out the Juan Nunez podcast than with that. I think it sums up basically everything that we've been talking about the entire time, but particularly for Path 4. Don't be surprised if a few years down the line, the player who you're thankful to have on your team is Juan Nunez.
Definitely. And I think that wraps up, you know, the final part of the conversation, which is that, you know, Juan Nunez will not only you'll be thankful for having someone that knows what he's doing and can make the teammates around him better, but also he just plays. And one of the reasons why I think he's one of our favorite prospects is just aesthetic bias. He just plays a beautiful brand of basketball. If you like impossible passes, and if you like unexpected reads and deliveries, like he just plays one of the most aesthetically pleasing games in the entire class. So your team will thank him, your team's record will thank him, your team's player will be thankful to have him, and you'll just have fun watching him.
All right. Well, I kind of cut this question off at the pass, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Anything else before we wrap this one up?
No, I think we kept it nearly under an hour. So I'm just shocked that we didn't go on a tangent. So I think you better just give all the links before we something comes on our minds and we end up with a 90-minute podcast.
Yeah, before we get rolling too quickly, yeah. Let's just close it out with the plugs. So, all right, then. He is Ignacio Risotto. You can find him on Twitter at Airball, EYREBALL, which still makes me laugh every time I see it. And you can find his written work on No Ceilings NBA as well. You can find my written work on No Ceilings NBA, and you can find me on Twitter at NBA Johnson. As I mentioned, I wrote about Juan Nunez a little bit ago for my editor's notes piece for No Ceilings NBA, and also did a collaborative piece with Nick Thomas over on the Nick Thomas Substack. So check both of those out if you haven't already. If you've been enjoying the show, please take the time to leave a rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you might be using. That's always much appreciated on our end. And if you have any feedback on the deep dives related portion of the podcast, feel free to reach out to me either via Twitter or email, nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.